Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. Now, folks, if we could get our public servants to actually support the Constitution, stay within their enumerated powers, roles, responsibilities, and, you know, not steal our property, not steal our land, and not steal our powers, rights, and everything else, we would be doing very well. We got a lot of cleanup to do, but that's our fault. I mean, when your kids go into the kitchen, and you know the drawer they're opening up, they're opening up the knife drawer, or, you know, where the utensils and so forth, and there's knives in that drawer. And you see, you know, it's something that's a lot bigger than a normal fork or a spoon, and it's flat and shiny. You know, that's a knife. Now, that means that your child has made the decision to seize control over something that can cut and do, you know, damaging things. Now, would you let your kid just run out of the kitchen with that and not ask them where they're going with that? Or, I mean, or would you stop them and say, hey, since you're running with a knife, you hand them the scissors and say, run with these too? What do you say, Sean?
I say no.
Run with scissors. Okay, so, I mean, that makes sense. You wouldn't let your kids do this. And what is our government? Our government is our little creature we've created to serve us. I mean, it's far less, I understand, precious to us. I mean, it's not going to give, you know, us our grandchildren. But it's there to serve us. We've instituted for very specific purposes. Why would we allow them to go out and grab things that, you know, and assume powers and spend money on things they don't have the power or authority to do? We didn't form them to do these things. So, that makes sense, folks. We've got a lot of cleanup to do. Now, we need to start electing candidates that are constitutional champions. Jerry, or Gerald Wistrand, is that guy. His contact information is on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to my candidate endorsement, he's the one candidate I've endorsed. Now, I believe I'm going to have, at least I know a county commissioner out of South Dakota, Mike Mueller, is probably going to be signing the pledge, and he's going to be on there. So if you're from South Dakota, you're going to want to help him. I believe Mike Mueller is going to actually set up ground zero for the very first constitutional compliance committee in a county that'll be actually formed and sanctioned by the county commissioners of a county within South Dakota. I don't want to mention the county. Anyway, at this point. But that all being said, folks, please send Jerry some support. These guys that are standing in front of the monster, that, you know, like that tank in Tiananmen Square, we need to support these guys. Because if not them, then who? Because if it's not you, then there you go. We need to start supporting these guys that are willing to step in front of those tanks. So anyway, we had been going through the ratification debates, and you just hit the direct taxes, and we got some real good clarity out of there. As far as I'm concerned, I think he made it very clear. The only intent for direct taxes is for warfare, or those extraordinary measures that we must do and use to defend ourselves. Not because a government wants to spend more money and buy us into prosperity. Because when they're doing that, they're actually just corrupting us. Because they're getting money to get to the give to those who are going to put that money back into their pockets so that they can stay in power and stay in office and do more bad things. So anyway, The next part that we haven't hit. And actually, do you have any go-backs or anything, Sean? I'm sorry.
No, sir. But I was just going to say, that's a perfect example. I was looking at a report earlier today, is this this whole premise of the minimum wage. The government sets the minimum wage so that people can afford the cost of living, is, you know, a higher cost of living.
Right.
But they're the ones that are creating the higher cost of living. And by creating a minimum wage, all they're doing is exacerbating the problem even more.
Right.
And giving themselves the excuse to create more money out of nothing.
That is correct. That is correct. And so it is a huge problem. Huge problem, folks. And there's not one state out there that has, that I've ever seen, where you gave them that authority. Your state doesn't have it. You know, if your state has it, I want you to send me an email. I want you to give me a call. Just call our 202 number. It's on our contact page. Just call us and say, hey, I live in Rhode Island, and we gave our state the power to, you know, to basically establish, you know, the controls over labor, to just establish, you know, rent control, you know, wage control, all of that stuff. Yeah, we got it going on. These are assumed powers. So anyway, well, let's dive into Madison's next note. And when it's note, it's kind of that ambiguous, folks. So let's go ahead. Sorry.
But it is urged that its consolidated nature, joined to the power of direct taxation, will give it a tendency to destroy all subordinate authority. That its increasing influence will speedily enable it to absorb state governments. I cannot think this will be the case. If the general government were wholly independent of the governments of the particular states, then indeed usurpation might be expected to the fullest extent. But, sir, on whom does this general government depend? It derives its authority from these governments and from the same sources from which their authority is derived. The members of the federal government are taken from the same men from whom those of the state legislatures are taken. If we consider the mode in which the federal representatives will be chosen, we shall be convinced that the general would never destroy the individual governments, and this conviction must be strengthened by an attention to the construction of the Senate. The representatives will be chosen probably under the influence of the members of state legislatures. But there is not the least probability that the election of the latter will be influenced by the former. 160 members represent this commonwealth in one branch of the legislature, are drawn from the people at large, and must ever possess more influence than the few men who be elected to the general legislature. The reason often on this subject by a gentleman on the same side, Mr. Nicholas, were unanswerable, and have been so full that I shall add but little more on the subject. Those who wish to become federal representatives must depend on their credit with that class of men who will be the most popular in their counties, who generally represent the people in the state governments. They can, therefore, never succeed in any measure contrary to the wishes of those on whom they depend. It is almost certain, therefore, that the deliberations of the members of the Federal House of Representatives will be directed to the interests of the people of America. As to the other branch, the senators will be appointed by the legislatures, and though elected for 6 years, I do not conceive they will so soon forget the source from whence they derived their political existence. The election of one branch of the federal by the state legislatures secures an absolute dependence of the former on the latter. The biennial exclusion of one-third will lessen the facility of a combination and may put a stop to intrigues. I appeal to our past experience, whether they will attend to the interests of their constituent states. Have not those gentlemen who have been honored with seats in Congress often signalized themselves by their attachment to their seats? I wish this government may answer the expectation of its friends and foil the apprehension of its enemies. I hope the patriotism of the people will continue and be a sufficient guard to their liberties. I believe its tendency will be that the state governments will counteract the general interests and ultimately prevail. The number of representatives is yet sufficient for our safety, and will gradually increase. And if we consider their different sources of information, the number will not appear too small.
Okay. So
I bet he's rolling over in his grave. Because all of those things that he feared ended up coming true. And not much longer afterwards, I've been working on our codfish rebounding presentation. It's just ridiculous. All of these things that he said, then they ratified the Constitution, and then the very next session, they were right at it.
Right. Tried to reach into the pockets and, you know, get some of those silver shiny things or the shiny metal objects to fall on the floor so maybe they can pick some up. All right. So now Mr. Nicholas again steps in. And I think I mentioned this yesterday, that Nicholas shines. This man was a brilliant man. He understood the Constitution, and he was very good at explaining it. And he wasn't even at the Constitutional Convention. How is that? Huh?
Smart.
And it's this easy, folks. If it's not there, they can't do it. If you grasp that, then all of a sudden, what about a treaty with this, you know, UN government or the World Health Organization that, you know, they're going to basically invoke these, you know, vaccinations, and they're going to come in and shut us down if too many people are coughing and, you know, quarantine a whole city and that type of thing. But that's all for the good, and we're okay with it. No, they don't have the authority. That's something that's not enumerated. They have no business meddling in our health and in our bodies, period. That simple. And, you know, once you start getting it, then all of a sudden you can start to, you know, Rand Paul, people love Rand Paul because he can repeat that fundamental tenet that our government is, you know, the Constitution wasn't there to unlimit government. It was there to constrain it. It only gave them certain powers. I mean, so he's been able to at least, you know, be right most of the time, but he's still not right. He's not out there, you know, talking about the militia or talking about the invasion, not in context of the Constitution. So anyway, let's dive into this note by Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, if the resolution taken by the House of going regularly through the system, clause by clause, had been followed, I should confine myself to one particular paragraph. But as to my surprise, the debates have taken a different turn. I shall endeavor to go through the principal parts of the argument made use of by the gentleman in opposition to the proposed plan of government. The worthy gentleman entertained us very largely on the impropriety and danger of the powers given by this plan to the general government. But his argument appears to me inconclusive and inaccurate. It amounts to this, that the powers given to any government ought to be small. I believe this, sir, is a new idea in politics. Powers being given for some certain purposes ought to be proportionate to that purpose, or else the end for which they are delegated will not be answered. It is necessary to give powers to a certain extent to any government. If a due medium be not observed in the delegation of such powers, one of two things must happen. If they be too small, the government must molder and decay away. If too extensive, the people must be oppressed. As there can be no liberty without government, it must be as dangerous to make the powers too limited as too great.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so now
learned that in the Articles of Confederation, you would think.
That's right. Now the commission comes up because he's going to address somebody talking about these guys violated their commission. Go ahead.
He tells us that the Constitution annihilates the Confederation. Did he not prove that every people had a right to change their government when it should be deemed inadequate to their happiness? The Confederation being found utterly defective, will he deny our right to alter or abolish it? But he objects to the expression, we the people, and demands the reason why they had not said, "We, the United States of America." In my opinion, the expression is highly proper. It is submitted to the people because on them it is to operate. Till adopted, it is but a dead letter and not binding on anyone. When adopted, it becomes binding on the people who adopt it. It is proper on other account. We are under great obligations to the Federal Convention for recurring to the people the source of all power. The gentleman's argument militates itself against himself. He says that persons in power never relinquish their powers willingly. If then the state legislatures would not relinquish part of the power they now possess to enable a general government to support the union, reference to the people is necessary. We are, in the next place, frightened by two sets of collectors who, he tells us, will oppress us with impunity. The amount of the sums to be raised of the people is the same, whether the state legislatures lay the taxes for themselves or for the general government. Whether each of them lays and collects taxes for its own exclusive purposes, the manner of raising it only is different. So far as the amount of the impost may exceed that of the present collections, so much will the burden of the people be less. Money cannot be raised in more judicious manner than by impost. It is not felt by the people. It is a mode which is practiced by many nations. 9/10 of the revenues of Great Britain and France are raised by indirect taxes, and were they raised by direct taxes, they would be exceedingly oppressive. At present, the reverse of this proposition holds in this country, for very little is raised by indirect taxes.
So let me ask you this. When we look at this idea of using imposts, and that was the intent, we got away from this when they went to income tax. You know that, right?
Right.
And they started placing a direct burden on us and not on foreign goods. I think I've said this before. That is when America began subsidizing communism, because we were no longer placing imposts on foreign goods. And as more and more nations were basically turning more towards collective labor, socialized governments, and communist governments, then we were there paying them whatever they were asking for their goods, instead of creating a deterrent for Americans to buy their products, because an impost would make their products more expensive than ours. Why buy their tomatoes when ours are going to be cheaper? Because we've got an impost increasing their costs. So, do you see? I'm just trying to get back around to this, how we've been subsidizing communism for well over a century. You see that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. And to me, when you look at it at its core, the whole communist ideal, whether you call it socialism or communism or whatever you call it,
statism.
It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just fooling people into believing that they hold the power and the government's going to take care of them.
Right.
And the government's not going to take care of you. If the government was the government is more likely to do what you need done to take care of yourself in the position where we are than if the government held control of all the means of the economy.
Right.
I mean, I don't understand how people with, and I mean, I can understand it from the indoctrination and the propaganda and just the standard of living where people don't have, it's very hard for someone in this country to starve to death. I mean, that sounds pretty brutal, but it's the truth. I mean, somebody somewhere is going to do something to help you. You know, regardless of your situation, if you have any inkling of motivation to help yourself, you're going to be able to survive.
Yep.
So, and I think that's where this idea came from. The more the government gives people and helps people, and that's why I get so aggravated when I hear these politicians talk about, well, we need to make life better for the American people. That's all a ruse. It's just like the communist ruse of the government taking care of you. No, they're not going to take care of you. They just use that as a ruse to get you to go along with them assuming more power.
Right. That's not their job. That's not why we created them. Right.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Very good. Very good. And so he also talked about the commission and how, you know, the AOC was absolutely impotent. So that's all good. That's all good. So let's dive down to the Article 5. Go ahead. What's that?
Then and now.
Yeah. And so let's look at Article 5. It's down towards the bottom of that paragraph. Go ahead.
The worthy member has exclaimed with uncommon vehemence against the mode provided for securing amendments. He thinks amendments can never be obtained because so great a number is required to concur. Had it rested solely with Congress, there might have been danger. The committee will see that there is another mode provided besides that which originated with Congress. On the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, a convention is to be called to propose amendments, which shall be a part of the Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof. It is natural to conclude that those states who will apply for calling the convention will concur in the ratification of the proposed amendments. There are strong and cogent reasons operating on my mind that the amendments which shall be agreed to by those states will be sooner ratified by the rest than any other that can be proposed. The convention which shall be so called will have their deliberation confined to a few points. No local interest to divert their attention, nothing but the necessary alterations. They will have many advantages over the last convention. No experiments to devise, the general and fundamental regulation being already laid down.
All right. Now this next one, martial law. Nobody's talked about this in any of the debates, but you can tell Virginia, they're concerned about the government, you know, all of a sudden shutting them down with martial law. Here we go.
But it is complained that they may suspend our laws. The suspension of the writ of habeas corpus is only to take place in cases of rebellion or invasion. This is necessary in those cases, in every other case. Congress is restrained from suspending it. In no other case can they suspend our laws, and this is a most estimable security. But the influence of New England and other northern states is dreaded. There are apprehensions of their combining against us. Not to advert the improbability and illiberality of this idea, it must be supposed that our population will, in a short period, exceed theirs, as their country is well settled and we have very extensive uncultivated tracts. We shall soon outnumber them in as great a degree as they do us at this time. Therefore, this government, which I trust will last to the remotest ages, will be very shortly in our favor. Treason consists in levying war against the United States or adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. The punishment of this well-defined crime is to be declared by Congress. No oppression, therefore, can arise on this ground. The security does away with the objection that the most grievous oppression might happen under color of punishing crimes against the general government. The limitation of the forfeiture to the life of the criminal is also an additional privilege.
Okay, thank you. All right, so they're going to get more into this down the road, because now that they've already crossed that, and that response, even though it was kind of clear, they're going to have to clarify it even further. And I believe it'll be Nicholas that'll actually do that. But let's go into Mr. Corbyn, who now talks about interposition and the militia. But before we do that, let's take a pause and have a promo. I'm in the mood for a promo. I don't know about you, Sean, but you know, the promo mood will prevail, and we will have a promo. And let it be written, and so let it be done. And here comes the promo, folks. We'll be right back after the promo. Thank you. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. All righty. So let's dive into, because we've had the promo, and so let's dive into this interposition by Mr. Corbin. Go ahead.
The honorable gentleman is possessed of much historical knowledge. I appeal to that knowledge, therefore. Will he not agree that there was a coercive power in the federal government of the Amphictyonics? The coercive power of the Amphictyonic Council was so great as to enable it to punish disobedience and refractory behavior in the most severe manner. Is there not an instance of it carrying fire and sword through the territories and leveling to the ground the towns of those who disobeyed it? Here Mr. Corbin mentioned particular instances. Is there no coercion in the Germanic body? This body, though composed of 300 different component sovereignties, principalities, and cities, and divided into 9 circles, is controlled by one superintending power, the emperor. Is there no coercive power in the confederate government of the Swiss? In the alliance between them and France, there is a provision whereby the latter is to impose and settle differences that may arise among them. And this interposition has been more than once used. Is there none in Holland? What is their stadtholder? This power is necessary in all governments. A superintending coercive power is absolutely indispensable. This does not exist under the present Articles of Confederation. To vest it with such a power on its present construction without any alteration would be extremely dangerous and might lead to civil war. Gentlemen must, before this, have been convinced of the necessity of an alteration. Our state vessel has sprung a leak. We must embark in a new bottom or sink into perdition.
Uh-huh. Okay, and then he also talks then about the militia. Go ahead.
Where is that part?
Way down. Just, yeah.
I have it in red. The honorable gentleman then urges an objection respecting militia, who he tells us will be made the instruments of tyranny to deprive us of our liberty. Your militia, says he, will fight against you. Who are the militia? Are we not the militia? Shall we fight against ourselves? No, sir, the idea is absurd. We are also terrified by the dread of a standing army. It cannot be denied that we ought to have the means of defense and be able to repel an attack.
Okay, so here he's pointing out that the militia is them, right? And he's basically saying, here's this person telling us that the militia is going to basically oppress us. But there's no evidence. In other words, some of these responses that we're seeing are basically responding again, but nobody, I'm so glad Madison did it up front when he basically called out Henry and the rest of the anti-federalists that pipe up, that they're not actually providing arguments against the Constitution. They're making emotional assertions that this opens a door so, you know, it could be abused. You're putting something out there. That's a sword, and somebody can pick that up and hurt somebody. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so when we see this, the point I'm really trying to make here is how Henry and the rest of the anti-federalists, when we dive into those things, very rarely do they actually make an argument that actually connects dots to anything and provides what I would call, you know, some level of reinforced ideas, support, or what have you. They're just, again, as Madison says, hey, prove it. Show me. Anyway, let's go down. Now, Mr. Henry talks, and then Mr. Randolph talks, and now we're getting into money. And this is where Mr. Randolph, now, again, these ratification debates have already talked, in these, just like the other ones, they talk about their own bad actions in the other states. That's what we're going to hear here. So let's go ahead. This is all great stuff, because now we can see why we need to have a gold and silver coin. And folks, as they talk about gold and silver coins here, just think of where we would be if we still had the gold and silver standards. Go ahead.
Money is the nerve, the life and soul of government. It is the utmost folly to say that a government could be carried on without this great agent of human affairs. Wars cannot be carried on without a full and uncontrolled discretionary power to raise money in an eligible manner. Excuse me. Nay, sir, government cannot be administered in time of peace without this power, for how is it to be done? It is needless to impress any further on the minds of gentlemen who hear me the necessity of this power in government. If so, ought the general government to be more circumscribed in the power of providing for its own safety and existence than any other government? Ought it to depend for the means of its preservation on other bodies? This is actually the case with the Confederation. The power of raising money was nominally vested in that system. In March 1781, even Maryland, the most backward state then, conceded that Congress should have the power of receiving and demanding their proportionate quotas of the states. This was an acknowledgement of the necessity of vesting a power in Congress to raise such sums as emergencies might require. But the means which were proposed had been found inadequate to compass the end. The propriety of the means is alone disputed. No doubt it is the universal opinion of the people of this commonwealth that its legislature should have the power of raising money at its own will and pleasure. There are two ways whereby this may be effected, by requisitions or taxation. There is no other manner, for it surpasses the ingenuity of man to devise any other mode of raising money than by one of these two methods. If the alternative of requisitions be determined upon as more eligible, it will not avail without coercion. If that of taxation be preferred, it will be sufficient without any coercion. If our legislature were to depend on requisitions for money to answer the ends of the government, then, sir, the absurdity and sophistry of the arguments urged in defense of such a mode of procuring money would strike the weakest intellect. If the mere pleasure of individuals were alone to be consulted, if it were left to the choice of your people to pay or not, your treasury would be much poorer than it is, and the advocates of this pernicious policy would perhaps be ashamed of their pertinacity. Suppose for a moment the only existing mode of raising a revenue in Virginia to be that of requisitions. Suppose your requisitions sent on to every county, say that money is wanted, assume the most pressing language. We earnestly entreat you, we humbly supplicate and solicit you would furnish us with 1,000 or 100 pounds to defray the necessary charges of our government. What would be the result of such applications for voluntary contributions? You would be laughed at for your folly, for thinking human nature could be thus operated upon. From my knowledge of human nature and of my countrymen, I am perfectly certain this would be the case.
Right. So you can't bank on people just reaching in their pocket to help you out. You have to have the coercive power. Okay, so now he gets into some comments regarding the militia. Go ahead.
If the spirit of resentment actuates individuals, will not states be equally vindictive? What species of military coercion could the general government adopt for the enforcement of obedience to his demands? Either an army sent to the heart of a delinquent state or blocking up its ports? Have we lived to this, then, that in order to suppress and exclude tyranny, it is necessary to render the most affectionate friends the most bitter enemies? Set the father against the son and make the brother slay the brother. Is this the happy expedient that is to preserve liberty? Will it not destroy it? If an army be once introduced to force us, if once marched into Virginia, figure to yourself what the dreadful consequence will be. The most lamentable civil war must ensue. Have we any troops but militia to confront those disciplined bands that will be sent to force our compliance with requisitions? The most virulent railings are vented against the federal executive. We are told that the president can fix himself in the chair of state, establish himself as a monarch, and destroy the liberties of the people. It has too often happened that powers delegated for the purpose of promoting the happiness of a community have been perverted to the advancements of the personal emoluments of the agents of the people. But the powers of the president are too well guarded and checked to warrant this illiberal aspersion. Let us candidly consider the consequences of the favorite plan of requisition and see whether instead of imaginary or problematical, there be not real palpable dangers. To compel your obedience, a rapacious army will penetrate into the bosom of your country, carrying destruction and desolation before it. The commander of such an army will be liable to the corruptions and passions incident to other men. If he possesses a military genius, address, and ambition, he may procure this army to proclaim him king. Who can tell the result? Who can oppose him with success? Who can say to him, "Sir, you shall not be a despot"? The reasoning, however inconclusive or illogical it may appear to some, is, in my estimation, more accurate than arguments drawn from the possibility of a president becoming a tyrant.
Okay. So, again, this is all Governor Randolph. And now Governor Randolph actually kind of talks a little bit about sheriffs. Go ahead. And this is, how many times have we talked about sheriffs? In the ratification debates, did it come up at all so far? And the answer would be no. So, go ahead.
Correct. I'm having a problem here.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine.
Yeah, there we go. I froze up for some reason.
In the middle of the summer. You froze up in New Orleans. Okay.
In the middle of the summer.
My empathy. You must be enjoying that. All right, so it's page 69. It is Governor Randolph, and it's the comments on the sheriff.
Let us consider this dispassionately and whether the idea be well-founded, which is suggested that a conflict will frequently happen between the state and congressional collector for property seized and claimed by both. If there be no necessity or strong temptation to increase the present number of officers, no addition will be made to them. Congress will have every inducement, and from the mode of their appointment must be inclined to lighten the burdens of the people. They can derive no advantage from a contrary conduct. In other countries where the fate of the poor is wretched, officers are created merely for the emolument of certain individuals. But by the structure of this government, the interests of the people must always be considered, nor will any but necessary officers be created. The number of officers and their compensations will be as inconsiderable as the nature of the business will admit of. With respect to collectors of the general taxes, I have not the least doubt that Congress will employ the state officers and sheriffs because it will be economical and agreeable to the people. A considerable sum will be saved by it. They will employ such men, Mr. Chairman, unless they determine to throw away the public money in an unjustifiable manner.
There you go. All right. So now Mr. Madison comes back up. And as a matter of fact, I believe there's going to be a gap here. What ends up happening is Madison ends up missing almost a week of the debates because of the bills. He just, you know, he just can't make it to the meetings. He's just suffering. And so anyway, so Mr. Madison then again talks about the 13 independent sovereignties. It's a, again, nice and short, succinct, and to the point.
Ready?
Yep, go ahead.
A government which relies on 13 independent sovereignties for the means of its existence is a solecism in theory and a mere nullity in practice. Is it consistent with the reason that such a government can promote the happiness of any people? It is subversive of every principle of sound policy to trust the safety of a community with a government totally destitute of the means of protecting itself or its members.
So, in other words, a government that uses and is completely dependent on the 13 states, because the argument is that this federal government is going to wipe out the states. And really, it can't, because it depends upon it. The Senate itself, at that point in time, was selected by the state legislatures. Today, it's by the people, but they're still representing the state legislatures. And when we look at the House, I mean, that's representing the people in congressional districts out there in the Senate. The idea of the federal government wiping out the state government would be, it's at a level of unconstitutionality, because bottom line, businesses, how would businesses register? The federal government has no authority to conduct, regulate, and form or allow the formations of businesses. They don't have that power. There'd be so many different things that the federal government would need amendments to the Constitution to do. Now, to be clear, we see now today that the federal government doesn't care about the amendments and it'll just assume the power. I get that. But to wipe out the states is another thing, completely another thing. Now, Madison then talks and makes a comment, a short quip about the safety in the Union.
Mr. Madison then recapitulated many instances of the prevalent persuasion of the widest patriots of the states that the safety of all America depended on union, and that the government of the United States must be possessed of an adequate degree of energy, or that otherwise their connection could not be justly denominated a union. He likewise enumerated the expedients that had been attempted by the people of America to form an intimate association for the meeting at New York in the year 1754 downwards, and their sentiments on this subject had been uniform, both in their colonial and independent conditions, and their variety of causes had hitherto prevented the adoption of an adequate system.
Okay. Now, Mr. Henry gets up and speaks. He goes a little while, kind of a long while, but anyway, now we go into a new day. Henry's still talking. And Henry makes a comment regarding the militia. So this is, again, an anti-federalist comment. Let's take a look at this. Go ahead.
Ready? I am trying to find it.
It's Monday, June 9th, and then Henry talks. I mean, he's the first one talking, and it's a comment within that body.
You don't have a page number?
Yeah, it's on 91. Sorry.
Right, there we go. I don't know why I don't have tabs on this document.
Well, that's because you had a little brush of winter in the middle of summer.
All right. 24, militia. The clause which says that Congress shall, quote, provide for arming, organizing, disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers, seems to put the states in the power of Congress. I wish to be informed if Congress neglected to discipline them, whether the states were not precluded from doing it. Not being favored with a particular answer, I am confirmed in my opinion that the states have not the power of disciplining them without recurring to the doctrine of constructive implied powers. If by implication the states may discipline them, by implication also Congress may officer them, because in a partition of power, each has a right to come in for part, and because implication is to operate in favor of Congress on all occasions, where their object is the extension of power, as well as in favor of the states. We have not one-fourth of the arms that would be sufficient to defend ourselves. The power of arming the militia and the means of purchasing arms are taken from the states by the paramount powers of Congress. If Congress will not arm them, they will not be armed at all. There have been no instances shown of a voluntary cession of power sufficient to induce me to grant the most dangerous power. A possibility of their future relinquishment would not persuade me to yield such powers. Congress, by the power of taxation, by that of raising an army, and by their control of the militia, had the sword in one hand and the purse in the other. Shall we be safe without either? Congress have an unlimited power over both. They are entirely given up by us. Let him candidly tell me where and when did freedom exist, when the sword and purse were given up from the people. Unless a miracle in human affairs interposed, no nation ever retained its liberty at the loss of the sword and purse. Can you prove by any argumentative deduction that it is possible to be safe without retaining one of these?
Okay, so now let's do this, because people read this, and this is Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry would not be a scoundrel and misrepresent information, would he? So I'm going to let you read along as I read this clause, actually out of Article 1, Section 8. And it says, Congress shall have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Now, you keep note if there's anything missing or different. Comma, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Anything missing?
Nope. He lied.
Ah.
Or maybe he just misunderstood.
Oh, but no. So the answer was, yes, there's things missing. That whole last part where the training was to be done by the states, as Congress prescribed. And the reason you want to have Congress prescribe the discipline of, you know, how they're to function, operate, you know, they want to make sure everybody is firing in the same ways, you know, so that, you know, the way you're used to working in a foxhole, you know, how the fields of fire are done, you know, how you form, all that type of stuff. Because if everybody's doing it differently, then it becomes a let me just say it so that I'm politically incorrect. It becomes a Chinese fire drill. I mean, it's just a mess.
I thought you were going to say something else.
No, but I mean,
I thought you were going to use one of those marine terms.
No. Oh, yeah. The CF, huh? No, I wasn't going to go there.
Yeah, no.
A Chinese fire drill. See, it's still CF, right, though, right? Okay, so there we go, folks. The whole point is, here he says that they don't have the power, because he completely dropped it. He didn't say, and the authority of training the militia, of course, so the states have the authority to do this. And then he goes on and says, seem to put the states in the power of Congress, I wish to be informed. If Congress neglected to discipline them, whether the states were not precluded from doing it. Well, it says right here that they're supposed to be doing it. The point is that Congress is supposed to pay for it. This part right here, to provide for That means that if there's costs of, you know, organizing, if there's cost to arming, if there's cost to disciplining, going out and exercising and you know, making sure everybody knows what to do and is real well skilled in, you know, what they need to do, and the governing of them is part to be employed by the service of the United States. Okay, then the rest is, this is what they're handing over to the states, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of the training and militia. So in other words, each state is supposed to be training their armed forces for the Army, Air Guard, what have you, for the militia and the Federal Army. Each state is supposed to have the responsibility of their own training facilities. They don't do that now. As a matter of fact, most training facilities, where did you go to your training facility? What state did you enlist in?
I enlisted in Louisiana, but I did my basic in Missouri.
Okay, and then where did you go for your A school, your MOS?
Georgia.
See, folks, all of it should have been right there in Louisiana. Now, I get it that the federal government is saving money, but the point is that all states, because how many states don't have any training at all for their military, for the militia, at all? None.
No, and the crazy thing is they do have places that I could have got the same training in Louisiana that I got in Missouri, because they do have basic here.
Oh, they do have basic there? Mm-hmm. I don't think that they're in Wyoming, they have any type of training at all.
Right.
And I think that there's other states that they really don't have any training, or it's very limited. And so the real question is, why? Why don't they just allow the states to ensure, you know, create the plan so everybody knows how to do it? Yeah, that right there. If the states all have the, you know, the SOPs, the standard operating procedures, the guides, the manuals of what and how they're supposed to do everything, then they would have the knowledge of being able to prepare and actually be able to do and prepare their militia, form their militia, that type of stuff. But not giving it to them pulls it back and lets the federal government control. So actually, the way the Constitution was written, it ensured that the states had full visibility. But today they don't. How many Marine Corps boot camps are there? There's only two. But see, the Marine Corps is different because the federal government actually has that specific authority with the Navy. But the Army and the Air Guard and the National Defense System, no. Each state, they should have a full visibility so that they can run and maintain their own training. Now, I get it that there's a lot of different MOSs and so forth. But even in today, a lot of that stuff could be even virtual. Where, you know, what do you want to call it? We ran out of time, but the academics can all be done virtually. You know, the hands-on and that type of stuff. You really need to be able to be at the facilities and so forth. I get that type of stuff. It's not just muskets and powder like it was back then. But what they're doing requires an amendment. If not, it's unconstitutional. It's just that simple, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.